outside. And all them crazy murderers would never run from inside. You try to keep me down cause you see no joy. All them knows them from, so you call a man a boy. I ain't a tie, can't just see. Open up your eyes.
The thing that makes Judaism dangerous to everybody, to every race, to every nation, to every idea, is that we smash things that aren't true. We don't believe in the boundaries of nation state. We don't believe in the ideas of these individual gods that protect individual groups of people. These are all artificial constructions, and Judaism really teaches us how to see that. In a sense, our detractors have us right in that we are a corrosive force. We're breaking down the false gods of all nations and all people because they're not real.
Sunday, October the 29th, 2023, and you are listening to today's very early morning edition of the Ugly Truth broadcast. Welcome to the program, folks. Hope you're all doing well. Those of you of goodwill, as we like to say on this program often, those of you who are not of goodwill and who have dedicated yourselves to the destruction of the rest of us, well, in the words of the late, great, and greatly missed Mike Piper, may he rest in eternal peace. You can all take a running jump straight into hell. Anyway, folks, yes, it's only been, gosh, less than a week, and here we are back together again, and lots to talk about. So, you know, folks, on the last program, I said that I didn't feel particularly confident about it. I felt that I was very disjointed, and I received a few emails from folks who had listened to it, and they said, no, this was one of your best, which I don't understand, folks, because on the programs that I feel really good about, I say, yeah, that was a good program, happy. You know, I don't hear that much, for lack of a better word, praise on them. And then the ones where I feel like I just went out there and just threw a bunch of paint up against a canvas, you know, these are the ones that I get emails from folks saying this was the best thing you've ever done, and I just don't get it. I don't get it. But anyway, on that note, folks, last week's program, I felt I was very disjointed. The program was very disjointed because it was in the middle of the day, and in the middle of the day, really, I'm good for nothing else except doing the work here on the rancho that needs to be done, especially as we're getting into winter. And so I have a hard time focusing on these more cerebral issues like we cover on this program when it's in the middle of the day. Right now, folks, it is it's just an ungodly, ridiculously early hour here on Sunday morning, which is when I do my best thinking and my best work, in my opinion. Now, I'm sure that I'll probably hear from people later on, you know, after, let's say that I do the program today and I feel pretty good about it, I'll probably hear from people saying, yeah, it was okay, or something along those lines. on that note, folks, I do appreciate the kind words, and I also appreciate the support that we get in terms of helping to do this thing that we do here. It requires time, it requires money, it requires a lot of brain power, a lot of cerebral power. And so those of you who are generous and open up your wallets and help us out in that regard, we greatly appreciate it. So we have a pretty packed, busy program lined up for you today, folks. One of the things that I heard in the handful of emails that I received from people who had heard the program, last week's program, was how disturbing they had found it. And by the way, folks, if you hear this hissing in the background, that is what is disturbing you, I have a little heater here in my man cave, my little office. Very, very cold up here in the Pacific Northwest right now. And I have to have this heater on. Otherwise, you're going to hear me with my teeth chattering. So if that is being picked up by the microphone, I apologize. It's just a necessary evil in order to do this program. Anyway. The one word, one adjective that we received after last week's program was the word disturbing. And of course, the reason for this disturbing nature of the program is the fact that we showcased, centerpieced, spotlighted, whatever word we want to use, recordings of these various creatures from within the Judaic community, followers of Judaism. And they were talking about, and I think they were all rabbis. I think every stinking one of them, every single one of them was a stinking rabbi. Sorry, folks, but there are just some words that have to go hand in hand, like mashed potatoes and gravy. Okay? So when you say the word rabbi, I always prefer to preface it by the word stinking, because I do stink, and Jesus Christ did too. And those of you right now, you know, who have studied the New Testament, studied the words of Jesus Christ, say to yourself, well, you're scratching your head saying, I don't remember Jesus ever referring to the rabbis as stinking. Well, folks, he referred to them in one of his last exhortations, trying to warn the rest of the Gentile world about the danger that these people pose to the rest of God's green earth. He referred to them as whitewashed tombs, meaning mausoleums, you know, that were clean on the outside, but inside were full of rotting carcasses and dead men's bones. Now, anybody who has driven by roadkill, you know, a deer or something like that that's been hit by a car and it's been sitting out in the sun for a day or so, knows the unmistakably horrible smell that is produced by the decay of that carcass. It stinks, folks, just like these rabbis, okay, who Jesus referred to as mausoleums and as graves full of dead men's bones. It stinks in there, I guarantee you. You know, bury something and dig it up a week later, and it stinks. And so when I talk about these rabbis, of course, as purely as a my own personal devotion to Jesus Christ, I refer to them as stinking rabbis. Anyway, what was so disturbing about last week's program, folks, was that we all got to sniff for ourselves the stench of Judaism, and particularly the stench of what Judaism teaches with regards to all of us, the Gentiles, and especially those who are considered to be from the nation of Amalek, meaning the descendants of Esau, who the Jews believe, followers of Judaism believe, they are commanded to extinguish, to exterminate, to utterly remove Esau and his descendants from the earth and from all people's memories. This is the death curse under which all of us have been living for thousands of years, folks. Thousands of years before any of us were ever born. We were born into this world with a death warrant that had already been written against us by these people. And yes, folks, it is a very disturbing thing when you come to realize that this is the nature, this is the peculiar and perverse spiritual energy that is driving much of the world's events taking place right now, not the least of which is World War III, which is unfolding literally minute by minute as we speak. Well, folks, we're going to be continuing on in this vein. You know, those of you who follow the website know that it is a common introduction that I use whenever I'm going to post an article appearing in the Hebraic press, the Jewish press. I know I'm being redundant when I say that, folks, because the organized forces of anti-Gentilism, of course, they own, or at least have great influence over most of the mechanisms of media, of information, and all of the rest of that. So I realize it's redundant when I say that. But nevertheless, we need to, as those of you who read the website know, that I introduce many stories that appear in the Jewish press with the introductory, I guess you'd call it an introductory title, The Jewish Brain, quote unquote. Now, I say that, folks, because it's absolutely imperative that in order to understand any person or a group of people, why they are the way they are, who they are, why they behave the way that they do, you have to understand how their brains function. You know, like, for example, somebody who knows me really well, if somebody who didn't know me very well were to go to somebody who knows me really well and say, if he had his choice between going to Wendy's or going to Little Caesar, okay, or some other Italian restaurant, which would he choose? Well, knowing my brain, the way that my loved ones and my friends know me, they'd say, oh, he would definitely choose, you know, the Italian restaurant. And if somebody who didn't know me were to ask a question of the same person, well, if he had to choose between going to an Italian restaurant or, let's say, for example, a Lebanese restaurant, which one would he go to? Oh, he would go to the Lebanese restaurant. Okay. People who know me, they know my brain, they know how my brain functions. Furthermore, if somebody were to ask, you know, what kind of company does he prefer to keep? Would he like to, would he like to spend the day with a guy named Moshe? That's the Hebraic name for Moses, folks. Or would he like to spend the day with somebody named Muhammad? Well, anybody who knows me knows that I would much prefer the company of somebody named Muhammad than I would somebody named Moshe, because I understand how the person named Moshe, I understand how their brain functions, and likewise, I understand how the person with the name Muhammad, I know how their brain functions, and I know that the person with the name Muhammad, his brain functions in a much more agreeable fashion with my brain than does Moshe. And so, like I said, folks, we have to understand how the brains work of these people who hold such an unbelievable amount of influence over our world, literally, who have a rusty razor blade at our throats, our collective throat, and who are poised to kill us at any moment. We have to understand how their brains work in order to understand, number one, how we got into this fix, where this person got close enough to us that they were able to get this this razor blade next to our throat, and number two, how to get away from this person. Now, those of you who have the dubious honor of knowing me closely know that it's a constantly recurring theme with yours truly, my frustration and aggravation with people who don't get it, who do not understand why this particular group of people behave the way that they do, and the fact that it has been sitting there literally as an open conspiracy against all of us for about 4,000 years. And it does not require anybody to have any kind of command with the Hebraic language. Doesn't require anybody to sit down and read all 5,000 pages of the Talmud. The nature of this conspiracy against us, the nature of this razor blade being put up against our throats, is sitting there right within the one book that probably can be found in every home throughout the world, and that is the Bible. You just go back to that section in the very beginning, the Old Testament, and you start reading for yourself with an open, uncluttered mind, folks. Now, I have to say that, I have to qualify that, because there are plenty of people these days who do read these things in the Old Testament, in the Torah, the Jewish Torah, and they say, well, yeah, but there's always a but. There's always an exception, you know, whether it's murdering innocent people, whether it's sexually abusing children, taking little girls, Gentile girls, as sex slaves. Okay, we're going to be hearing about that on today's program, folks, in our exploration of this topic, the Jewish brain. And there's always an exception. They always say, yeah, well, that's what God wanted then. But God doesn't want that now. Okay. As if back then, murder, incest, child, you know, raping children, things like that, that was something that God wanted then. But somehow God has reformed himself. He has turned over a new leaf, and now we're not supposed to do any of that anymore. I don't believe that, folks. I don't think that the creator of the universe ever, ever wanted murder and genocide, sexual abuse of children, rape, things like that. I don't think this is something that he ever wanted. And this is what I meant about approaching all of this with an uncluttered mind. Religion can be a wonderful thing, folks, okay? It's a necessary thing, just like government is a necessary thing. If we didn't have laws and if we didn't have police to enforce those laws, it doesn't take much of an imagination for us to figure out what's going to happen as a result of that. Okay, it will be chaos. At the same time, however, government, while it is necessary, there's good government and there's bad government. Okay. Likewise with religion. I think religion is a necessary thing. We have to have it. Okay. Simply for the simple reason that civil government can't be there with us 24 hours a day to regulate our behavior. And so we have to believe in something higher than ourselves, bigger than ourselves. Whether it is religion, a higher being that created us, or whether it is the government. But it has to be made, religion has to be made out of the right stuff, and it has to be done in the right proportions. And so these folks, especially of the Christian variety, who these days they just refuse to let to look at the Old Testament, the Torah, this very peculiar and perverse energy right now that just lit the fuse in World War III, folks, in case you haven't been paying attention to the events of the last 3 weeks. They just won't let go of that. They say, no, this is a holy book. The words of Moses and the actions of Moses are just as holy as the words and the actions of Jesus Christ. And it prevents them from coming to grips with the fact that right now, our world is being ripped to shreds because of this, because of the incontrovertibility. No, I'm sorry, wrong word. The incompatibility with the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Moses. Moses was a murderer. He was a warlord. He instructed his Hebrew soldiers to go out and to slay entire cities of people. Now, whether this really happened or not, folks, is immaterial. The fact of the matter is that you have a nation state in the Middle East that is receiving as much as $30 million a day from the United States, is armed to the teeth with not only nuclear weapons, but biological weapons as well that could wipe out every living thing on God's green earth, okay? And this nation state believes that all of these things that Moses commanded, that these did happen, and that they're good things. And they're basically here to finish up what their ancestors were unable to accomplish 2,000 years ago after the Romans came in and put the kibosh on the whole thing by destroying Judea and Jerusalem and scattering the Jews to the four corners and saying, don't ever come back here again under pain of death. So, as I said, folks, we have to understand this with an uncluttered mind, where we say, okay, my religion says that, you know, Moses was a saintly man and he was a precursor to the person of Jesus Christ, but I don't think that that's true. And right now, this is not just an academic exercise. We need to understand how the brains of these people function in order to, as I said before, folks, get the razor blade off of our neck, or to understand how the razor blade got there, and number two, how to put as much distance between ourselves and these people who intend to kill us as possible. The Jewish brain, folks, that's what today's program is going to be about. And there's lots of stuff that we could discuss with regards to the slaughter, the massacre that's taking place. I'm just going to say one thing about that. Again, folks, all of this is happening not because of the teachings of the Talmud, but because of the teachings of the Torah. On the website, we have gone to ridiculous lengths in proving over and over and over again that it is the Torah and all of its commandments for war and genocide and enslavement and all of the rest of that that functions as this peculiar energy driving these people and their behavior. It is the Torah, and it does have, you can look at what is going on right now, and you can see, you can draw direct lines between this and what the Jews have been taught, the Jews meaning the followers of Judaism, for thousands and thousands of years. And one quick thought. Yes, folks, I bring up the person of Jesus Christ quite a bit. Because I think, well, in addition to the fact that I revere this man and I see him as the greatest example of humanity that has existed within history, there are things that he told us about these people of a very warning nature that obviously we did not give it the attention that it deserves, and this is the reason that we're in the mess that we're in right now. Now, those of you out there, I'm sure, those of you listening to this program, I'm sure you've tried to have conversations with some of your friends, family members, neighbors, co-workers, whatever, about everything going on in Gaza right now. And depending upon what side of the political spectrum these people happen to fall, you know, especially if they fall in the on the right side of things, I'm sure you have experienced now for yourself firsthand basically an absolute repeat of what we saw take place immediately after 9/11. How people just believed uncritically, without any skepticism, how they're believing everything that is coming out of the Jewish press. Again, folks, I know I'm being redundant and repetitive in saying that, but nevertheless, it is what it is. About these Hamas fighters who are raping women, which, by the way, folks, as you're going to hear on the program today, is completely sanctioned. Okay, the Jews and their Torah specifically command their soldiers to rape Gentile women that they take as prisoners of war. Nevertheless, the story's coming out about Hamas raping women and beheading babies and things like this. And, you know, especially if these are people on the right side of the political spectrum, they just believe it all whole hog. They don't have any, it's in many ways, folks, for me at least, it's worse than 9/11, okay? It's impossible to have a rational conversation with these people and to say, wait a minute, do you understand, first of all? And they say, well, I saw the pictures. Okay, well, pictures of what? Okay, pictures of what? News coming out, even from Israeli sources, are saying that hold on, folks. Friend of mine just commenting on one of the stories on the website about the terrorist attacks. Yes, I know. We're screwed. Hold on, folks. I got to do this. The news coming out of from Israeli sources is saying that a lot of these deaths that took place when Hamas attacked, that it was done by the IDF itself. They have this doctrine known as the Hannibal Doctrine or the Hannibal Directive, whereby if one of their soldiers or any civilians stands a chance of being kidnapped and being used as hostages by the other side, The IDF is instructed to kill them, kill their own people, kill their own fellow soldiers so that they cannot be used as bargaining chips. Okay. So several of the people who were on the ground when these invasions from these Hamas fighters were taking place are saying that we witnessed the IDF gunning down civilians, Israeli civilians. Nevertheless, folks, trying to have a rational conversation with a lot of these people is almost as impossible, if not worse, than it was immediately after 9/11. And I think I made the case on last week's program that it's like arguing with pro-aborts, meaning people who are in favor of legalized child. It doesn't matter what arguments that you give them. You can talk about the development of the child at so many weeks. It has heartbeat, it has brain waves, it sucks its thumb, it does all of these things. It's got, you know, two arms, two legs, you know, all the rest of that stuff. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You can show them pictures. Look, here's a picture of a child that has been ripped to pieces. See that? That's an arm. That's a leg. That's an arm. That's a leg. That's a torso. That's a head. And they still will not. They will not yield an inch because they have this emotional attachment to this thing that overpowers their ability to reason even in a moral fashion. And so likewise with this one as well, folks, you know, the Christian evangelical right that prides itself on being pro-life and against child murder is as silent as death when it comes to the right to life being violated in the deliberate murder of 8,000 people in Gaza in the last 3 weeks, half of them children. Many of them mothers-to-be who went into early labor and now whose children have been born premature and are going to die within hours or days or something like that because all of the infrastructure, including healthcare, has been completely destroyed. So the one thing that I wanted to mention here, folks, is that Jesus warned. He said when he was casting his curses against the Jewish leadership of his day, he said, you know, he called them tombs, graves full of dead men's bones. And he also said, you travel over land and sea to win a single convert, to bring him into, you know, your religion. And then once you have your clutches upon him, you turn him twice as much into a child of Satan as you are. And folks, when we look at the Christian evangelical community, particularly in the United States and in the other English-speaking countries of the world, no better example exists of that. These people have taken so much of that Judaism into their souls. Just listen to If you happen to be driving, just go to any of these Christian radio stations. Usually they're up at the higher end of the frequency spectrum. And all of their talk, everything, there's supposed to be Christian radio programs. Virtually all of it is centered in the Old Testament. Moses and Joshua and David and Solomon and all of these other warlords. Okay. And so because they have taken in so much of that Judaism, they have left their Christianity. And as Jesus correctly said, no man can serve two masters. You're either going to love the one and hate the other, or you will hate the one and love the other. And so in this regard, folks, what I would tell you is trying to have a rational conversation with these folks, with these people, is a waste of time. It's like trying to argue with pro-aborts, trying to show them the proof. Look, this is a child. This is a living human being. It doesn't matter because they have this emotional attachment to this thing and they ain't letting it go. Pardon the bad grammar. Anyway, folks, today, the Jewish brain, we're going to be talking about this. We're going to be listening to lots of very interesting sound bites that are going to act as a microscope of sorts in studying the diseased nature of this thinking and why we find ourselves in the mess that we're in. Now, in particular, folks, the things you're about to hear, they're only tangentially related to what's going on right now, this giant late-term abortion going on in Gaza, where up to, at least as of this moment, as many as 8,000 people have been bombed, have been mass murdered, exactly as the Old Testament calls for. One of these programs that you're about to hear was done, 7 or 8 years ago. This podcast, it's a continuation of what we started on about a month ago, where they're having this little get-together. This group of Hebrews gets together in Israel, and they're talking about what their Torah, their Old Testament, commands them to do in times of war with regards to raping women in battle. Yes, folks, not from the Quran, not from a guy named Muhammad, but from the Torah, the Old Testament, the book that the Christians in the world consider to be just as holy as the New Testament and the words of Jesus Christ. Yeah, I'm sure I can see Jesus basically, you know, really sitting comfortably with that notion of raping women who have been taken in battle. So we're going to be listening to that. Now we're going to start off today's program with a soundbite that you heard I think a couple of weeks ago on one of the programs. But it does give us a good, it's a good way of introducing this topic. So let's just listen here for just a moment, folks.
So what will Israel's response be? Well, the Secretary of the Cabinet says this will be the last war against Gaza. This is going to be it right now. That remains to be seen. But, I think that people don't really understand the mentality that we're dealing with. I think they don't really understand who, if you can call them people, who they really are. Whether you like Jews, you don't like Jews, you think Zionists are evil, bandying around these tired expressions, you have to understand what's going on here in Israel is going to, I've always said this, but now it's clearer than ever that it will determine the fate of all humanity. And you know what else, Jim? I just want to say this to our Christian friends, mm-hmm. just to call it as it is and say it straight out, you guys are worshiping one Jew. That's a mistake. You should be worshiping every single one of us because we all die for your sins every single day. And that's exactly what's going on here. Yeah. We're all God's firstborn and we're dying for your sins right now because the Jewish people in the land of Israel are the bulwark against the orcs. Mm-hmm. Okay. The orcs are coming. Not to a theater near you, but to your home. Right. This is exactly. And so now I want to talk about something else, okay?
Okay, folks. That was a stinking rabbi. I can't remember what his name is right now off the top of my head. Stinking rabbi in Israel, and his co-host there is an obedient Christian Gentile who is doing exactly what this rabbi is calling for, which is bowing down and worshiping the Jews. He's very clear about that, folks. He said, that you should be worshiping each and every one of us because every day we die for your sins. Now, that's very important, folks. We're going to revisit that later. In fact, I'm going to jot that down. Let's see. Die for your sins. Okay? He's specifically referencing the Christians, okay? Every day we die for your sins. Meaning, because the Jews 2,000 years ago were stupid enough to go up against the Roman Empire and to think that they could win, which ended in predictable results. You know, Yahweh wasn't there through any of it, folks. There was no, there were no plagues, to drive the Romans out. There was no the angel of death visiting the firstborn of the Romans. There were no frogs, no blood in the water. None of these silly things that we read about in the Jews' religious literature that they wrote for themselves. None of that happened. Yahweh was, sorry, folks, I'm trying to find this soundbite we're going to be using here, okay? He was AWOL in the extreme. So what this bearded, smelly rabbi is saying is that it's the Christians, okay? It's the Christians, whereas the traditional understanding that Jesus died for everyone's sins, okay? With the Jews, however, it's the Christians, okay, who bear the brunt, why the Jews are dying for their sins, not the sins of Gentiledom, but for the Christians in particular. And this is something that those of you out there who do wade into that tumultuous business of trying to convince your friends who are totally under the spell of this toxic Judaic influence, you know, you need to remind them that the Jews, the followers of Judaism, have sworn themselves to the utter destruction of Christianity. I mean, that's the real lesson of the 3 years that Jesus spent grappling with these people and fighting against them and warning all of us about it. They hate the Muslims because the Muslims represent basically an indomitable force. They hate the Muslims, but they really hate, capital H, capital A, capital T, capital E, the Christians. And they have sworn themselves to your utter ruination, your utter destruction. But he says something interesting. He says, you know, people don't understand this mentality, and he's inferring to Hamas. And that's true, folks. People don't understand the mentality. In this case, they don't understand the mentality of the Jewish brain or how the Jewish brain functions. It sees the world in a completely different manner than does the Gentile brain. Just like the brain of a wolf understands the world, sees the world in a completely different way than does the brain of a deer or a sheep. Completely different. And the moment that the sheep and the deer and all of the other animals that the wolf likes to use for dinner, the day that their brains stop understanding that fact, they do understand that. They understand that there is a complete incompatibility between the wolves and themselves. I know this for a fact, folks, because we have a small sheep farm here, sheep ranch, and the sheep, and we have a border collie, you know, who's very good at herding the sheep and all the rest of that. And the sheep, when they are out of the pasture, I let them out to wander around the property and eat. They never take their eyes off of that dog of ours. Never. Especially the mothers that have babies. They'll even when they bend down to eat, they're not looking at the ground, they're looking up at him. And it's because they know instinctively that he is devoted to their destruction, meaning to his dinner. Christians do not understand this. When he refers to the Hamas, he says, if we want to call them people. That's classic Judaism, folks. That's stuff that has made the news headlines in recent years, where these various religious authorities, especially in Israel, have gotten a little too confident and a little too cocky and have said things out loud that they would not dare to have said years ago, such as Gentiles are donkeys. That we're monkeys, we're animals in human form, and that we were created by the God of the Jews to be their servants and their slaves. Okay, we were just given this human form so as to better serve them. That's what he's referring to here, this stinking rabbi, when he says, you know, these people, if we want to call them that, because they don't see us as people, folks. They see us, as I said, as these creatures that were made to resemble human beings so that we can best serve them. And finally, what he says, when he says the orcs are coming for you. Well, that's language out of Lord of the Rings, folks. And the orcs were these creatures that lived below the ground. If you watch the movie, it was actually a very dramatic scene when they were being born. They just kind of erupt out of the earth and they start ripping apart the these birthing bags that they're in. And you know, they've got these very demonic and diabolical faces, and they're just like this swarm, this army that is bent on destruction of the whole world. But again, folks, the Jewish brain, you know, when he's talking about the orcs, without realizing it, he's talking about his own people, the followers of Judaism. These invaders, these destroyers, these enslavers, these usurpers, usurers, murderers, rapists. You know, I was having a conversation with somebody, a good friend of mine recently, and she doesn't understand, you know, this Middle East situation and what just happened with Hamas. But she wants to know. You can tell there are some people, they want to know. They're open. They know that we live in an age of deception, a 360-degree arc of deception. Everywhere you go, there's some amount of deception that is in it. And so she was asking me, and I said, okay. I said, when you get home, I said, get on the computer and look up this thing known as Nat Turner's Rebellion. Now, for those of you who don't know who Nat Turner was, he was a slave in the state of Virginia. This took place in 1831. He could read. He was very intelligent. And he had his wife and his children taken from him, sold to someone else. So he organized a rebellion in the state of Virginia. And he said, this is it. You know, we've had enough of this, this ungodly institution of slavery. We're human beings. We don't deserve to be treated like this. And he organized a slave rebellion. And in the process, about 55 to 60 whites, including children, women and children, were murdered. They were killed. Now, Turner's actions in killing these civilians, quote unquote, obviously were not justified. These little children didn't have anything to do with it. They were born into this, and you know, they are victims of their environment, victims of their circumstance, as much as the slaves were. Although, obviously, the life of a white slave owner is much easier than that of the slave. But nevertheless, this is what happens when you push people and when you put them in the corner where the only thing that they can do is to strike back violently and indiscriminately. Now, this thing, Nat Turner's Rebellion, took place exactly, almost exactly 30 years before the actual outbreak of war between the North and the South. 30 years. For 30 years, you know, and that rebellion, that should have been a wake-up call to the country to say, look, this thing happened and it could happen all over the country. We need to deal with this situation. We need to remedy this situation of owning other human beings as slaves, selling their family members so that they never see them again. Imagine that, folks. Just imagine. Okay. That's what we just saw with the invasion by Hamas, which Benjamin Netanyahu allowed to take place. This was a modern day reoccurrence of Nat Turner's rebellion. You know, they didn't just invade Israel and kill people because they led, you know, wonderful lives. Now, you're never going to hear this from the Jews, folks. You're never going to hear this because they, in order to get the West and especially America into this war, whether we're putting boots on the ground, whether we're giving weapons and money and political support to Israel, whatever, we can't have that discussion. But that is essentially what it is. It's just a modern-day reenactment, re-representation of Nat Turner's Rebellion. And the reason why the Jews will not allow this discussion to take place is because their Judaism holds sacrosanct the idea that the land belongs to them. Everything between the Nile and the Euphrates rivers, the entirety of the Middle East, folks. And so because, quote unquote, God gave them that land, anybody who fights against this is in effect fighting against God. Okay, folks, now we're going to jump into we're already at 45 minutes. Oh boy. Now we're going to go ahead and do it, folks, you know, because actually the commentary that I've gotten from people is that they say the programs are too short. not too long. I've had, really just one individual who made the commentary that, was just too long and, you know, nobody's got the time for that. Everybody else so far has said that they wish it was longer. Okay, then, folks, your wish is my command. Abracadabra, it's going to be a much longer program than just the 1 hour. And what we're talking about, folks, is slavery and rape in the Torah, okay, in the Old Testament. And the permissibility of doing these things, especially during a time of war, okay? And again, folks, this does not come out of the Talmud. This comes out of the Old Testament, the quote-unquote Torah, the same book which Christians, deluded Christians, believe is every bit as holy as the New Testament that contains the words and the life of Jesus Christ. Now, the gathering here is that you've got, I don't know, maybe a dozen or so Hebrews in Israel, and they're having this thing known as a shiur. Shur, S-C-H-U-R, something like that, some ugly Hebrew word, where they get together and they talk about what the Torah says and how they're supposed to implement this. And the topic for this discussion is raping Gentile women during a time of war. And remember, folks, the theme of this program is the Jewish brain. When you listen to the discussion that's taking place amongst these people, including women themselves, who, I mean, let's face it, men getting together and talking about raping women is one thing, but when you hear women participating in this discussion, it takes on a different tone altogether, a very disturbing thing, the fact that you have the women folk, even if they're not necessarily supportive of it, there nobody is sitting down and saying to themselves, wait a minute, this is crazy, this is what... You know, this religion that we belong to, that we have given our lives, and now we're standing at the precipice of World War III and Armageddon in order to defend. This is what it teaches and believes. I don't want to have anything to do with this. You don't hear any of that discussion taking place, folks. There's no impulse on any of their parts to abandon this and say, forget it. If this is what being a follower of Judaism is, that you come up with some moral justification for raping women against their will, I realize that's redundant, folks, raping women against their will, and that this is what God wants us to do, forget it, I don't want to have anything to do with it. No discussion like this takes place, folks. Okay, so here we go. We are going to jump into what is the second part of an hour-long lecture that was given years ago, I think 7 years ago. And unfortunately, folks, is only coming to light now over the airwaves or the Ethernet within the context of this little podcast being broadcast in North Idaho. So let's sit back and listen.
There's areas of our Torah that we don't touch. There's areas of our Torah we don't touch because we're afraid to touch. There's stuff we're supposed to unpack. There's stuff we always knew. For thousands of years, when we come back to our country, we're going to unpack certain things. And we don't unpack them because we're afraid of what we'll find. We're afraid that we're either going to end up with a giant Haredi community or a Jewish Iran. And because we're afraid of either having a giant Haredi community or a Jewish Iran, we reduce the Torah in the state of Israel to what it was in Galut. To its corner, it handles divorces, it handles marriages, it handles giur. That's basically the role of the Torah in our society. And it gives little certificates to restaurants that they're kosher. But we know that we have a civilization that's much bigger than that, and we've come back home after 2,000 years to unpack that and really try to create a society and a civilization that expresses the divine ideal in every sphere of human behavior and really does manifest our values, express our authentic values in a way that's appropriate for a 21st century nation state. And we can't begin to do that until we unpack. We realize there's a topic we should be covering. It's like the extreme other side topic. It's like the topic, if we can unpack this, then we can unpack everything in between. And so we decided tonight the shiur is going to be whether or not, first of all, the whole idea of the Eshet Yifat Torah, everyone knows what the Eshet Yifat Torah is?
Yes.
Okay, it's like when a Hebrew soldier sees a woman on the other side, and he can, you know, there's, we're going to get into what he can, cannot do, specifically what Kohanim are allowed to do or not allowed to do, because a Kohen has a unique situation where a woman who goes through a naturalization process, a Giyur process, and becomes part of Am Yisrael can't marry a Kohen. Right? So what is and we know that the average Hebrew soldier, when he takes a woman in battle, it's supposed to result, ideally, with him marrying her. So the question is, what does the Kohen do in battle? So we're going to try to cover all of these topics tonight. I'd really like Rav Gavriel to lead. So now that the introduction is out there, we can have the actual shiur.
Okay?
Okay, folks. So that was the introduction that appeared a few programs back, where our stinking rabbi is talking about, and it's very important. These are not incidental things. These are very important, the words that he's using, where he's talking about, you know, there are parts of our Torah that we don't touch, that we don't talk about. Okay. And we don't because we're afraid of what it means. Okay. He said, but now, okay, 2,000 years later, now that we're back, it's okay for us to unpack this and to take it out and to expose it to the light of day. Okay. We always knew we were going to do this, is what he says. We always knew that when we came back, that there were things that we were going to have to unpack. Okay. Not throw away, folks. Okay. All of us go through spring cleaning and we go through our stuff and we say, I don't need this. I don't need that. There's no reason to keep a calendar around from 2010. I'm going to throw that away. He doesn't say they throw it away. He says they unpack it. And this is very important, folks, because, you know, in this particular case, what we're talking about is raping Gentile women in battle and taking on Gentile slaves. But there's a whole lot of other nastiness within the Torah. Okay. We're witnessing this right now. What's happening in Gaza, where they are slaughtering thousands of people, most of them children. This is part of that unpacking process from the Torah, because the Torah says you go in and you kill everything. Leave nothing alive that breathes. I'm quoting it verbatim, folks, from the book of Deuteronomy. Leave nothing alive that breathes. Okay. So he's basically saying here, what he's saying is that all of these nasties, all of this nastiness within Judaism, within Torah Judaism, that has been kept hidden for 2,000 years, because they had to, folks. They didn't have their country. They were living amongst the Gentiles. They know that the Gentiles despise them, that there's this eternal war between Esau and Jacob, as we heard on last week's program. They know they can't openly discuss, they can't unpack these things while they're living in Gentile society. But now that they've got their country back, their country that their own God, Yahweh, somehow was unable to save from the might and the power of the Romans, now that they've got their country back, they're they're back with a vengeance, and they're going to start unpacking all of this stuff that has been lying dormant there for 2,000 years. Very similar, I would say, in many respects, folks, and especially all of you Christian Zionist types out there who might be listening to this program. All of this stuff laying dormant and unseen, very similar in the imagery that we read in the book of the Apocalypse about this beast coming out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and all of the rest of this stuff. Okay. It's amazing, folks, when, you know, because the Christian evangelicals today who support Israel, who've made something of an idol of sorts out of Israel and the Jewish people, they spend all of their time in the book of Revelations. It's the only New Testament book that they seem to have any interest in. Everything else is Old Testament. And especially that 13th chapter that talks about this beast that's going to rule the world with violence and all of the rest of the stuff. And yet they can't put two and two together and to see that this beast, which they keep waiting to arrive, that it's here and that they are already its worshipers. Okay. So that was the introduction, folks. Now we're going to skip ahead to the second part of this where they're actually talking about, the Torah's, commandment to take Gentile women in battle as sex slaves. So here we go.
So that's what Eshet Yafat Torah is. What is Eshet Yafat Torah? Eshet Yafat Torah is the idea that when we go out to battle, that there are sparks of truth that are trapped among our enemies. And we can notice it, but know that you can also be mistaken. And therefore, what you do is when you take the Eshet Yafat Torah in, the first thing you have to do is, wait a second. I saw something special there, but maybe it was just the glamour of her, you know, beautiful fingernails and the hair and whatever she had, right? So you shave off, that's why her head has to be shaven, and she grows out her fingernails, and she changes her clothing, and she has to sit there and cry for the loss of her parents. There's a machloket in the Gemara, where's the loss of her parents? One of the Tanaim says it's the loss of her parents, it's the literal loss of her parents, the fact that she's no longer with her people anymore. She's not hurt. That truth that I brought into me is no longer a part of that other truth, of that other camp. But there's also another meaning to it. And so Rabbi Akiva says that what is she mourning? She's mourning the loss of her avodah zarah, of the idolatry, of the religion that she had when she was over there.
Who brings that down? That's
Rabbi Akiva says. And the idea is that, yes, okay, so we're taking in truths. But you have to be very careful when you're taking truths. And this is something that the Jewish people, and that is the heart of being colonized, is when you're not careful anymore in taking the truth. Sometimes you can become the Eshet Yafat Torah that's taken captive by the other people, right? And sometimes you could think that you're free and that you're taking in a truth into you, but you've just been, you were blinded by the glamour, the ex-glamour of what you thought was right, really there, right? They're offering you a scholarship, and they're giving you money, but it's true. Like you see the truth there, but they're also giving you a lot of money, and you get a lot of fame, and you get a lot of respect, and you get all these beautiful things. So now, what do you have to do? You have to take this to your home, and shave it down, change the clothing, shave off the hair, grow out the fingernails. And let that truth sit there and mourn for 30 days. And then you can decide whether it's going to be a part of you or not. Whether you can take it in or not. And that's what we have to do every time we go forward. And we have to do it very slowly. Because if we don't, then we're losing ourselves.
Okay, folks. I understand that a lot of that is typical Judaic word salad. What he's doing here, this stinking rabbi, is... And remember, folks... The words of Jesus, if those of you out there of the Christian variety who say, well, that's not very charitable. Well, this is what Jesus said. You know, actually, this is the kindest of the things that Jesus said about these people. He said, you know, they were graves full of dead men's bones, and we know that it stinks inside those graves. So I call them stinking rabbis. Anyway, a lot of this is typical Judaic word salad. Where he's talking about the allegorical, you know, that when you take something that is Gentile. Okay, Gentile civilization, sparks of truth and things like that. And what you're supposed to do is you are supposed to, as a Jew, as a follower of Judaism, you are supposed to defile it. Okay, meaning you shave its head, shave a woman's head, you cut her fingernails, you make her put on all of this ugly clothing in order to shame her and to make her feel worthless. He's speaking allegorically here, but he's about to jump into the actual business of physically raping Gentile women in battle. And by the way, folks, he's saying, I haven't been able to find it on any of the Jewish websites. The Eshi Gufator is, I guess, the horrible Hebrew term, which means the Gentile woman slave. So we're going to jump back into this now.
If we don't, then we're being assimilated. If we don't, then we're taking in too many truths that we can't handle. And we might be blinded by all these other things, and that's part of the colonization of the Jewish people.
Didn't you say earlier that, like, right up next to this part about you can rape the woman, you can also, like, eat the bacon and drink the Jesus wine, like, so how is that not part of the same category of just, like, giving it to your...
There's a principle in the Torah that there's nothing that's holy, totally forbidden. Okay? There are things that seem forbidden, and things that are permitted, but every... Everything has its place, and every person has its hour. There's a time where everything is permissible. There is an idea that everything can be, under certain circumstances, can be permitted. And those are things that are permitted. Those things are permitted in battle.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that, like, I find it okay. It's a nice thought to say, like, oh, I'm just freeing her from her thing, and she's got a spark of truth inside. That's nice. But it's also right up next to the part where it's saying, like, okay, in this certain circumstance, we'll give you, like, the permission to do all these other bad things. So it kind of seems as if it's also saying, this is a bad thing, we're letting you do it.
It is.
Both.
It is. It is absolutely referred to as a compromise with the Yetzer Hara. But, by the way, the Yetzer Hara is not bad. Okay? Like, the evil inclination is
good. The raw thing threw me off.
What's that?
The raw thing threw
me off. Yeah, it's deceptive. Like, it's called Yetzer Hara, but it's just, like, got a bad name.
It's unholy.
Yetzer Hara is actually the best thing that there is. Yetzer Hara is the only thing that was actually created in the world. Because what is Yetzer Hara? Yetzer Hara, it says in the Gemara also that one day, like, they came and they slaughtered Yetzer Hara, and then there were no more children, and there were no more people didn't advance anymore. But in other words, Yetzer Hara is what moves us forward. The question about Yetzer Hara is, how are we going to use it? Are we using it for good, or are we using it for bad?
Okay. So is there a good part of the bacon and a good part of the other? Like, are there good?
Yeah.
We're freeing the wine also?
Absolutely. Not only that, I'll tell you something. There's a law that is actually very interesting. Am I allowed to eat bacon?
No.
Thank you.
No.
I'm not allowed to eat bacon.
Depends.
Well, in battle, no. I can. Okay, thank you. But what happens if a little squirt of bacon falls into my porridge? Okay? Am I allowed to eat that porridge? If there's 60 times more porridge than the squirt of bacon, I'm allowed to eat that porridge. Now, the question is, I know that bacon squirted into that porridge. And I know there's 60 times more than the bacon. So it's permissible, but now should I eat it or should I not eat it?
Don't
what do you think the rabbis say? What would you say?
I wouldn't eat it.
You wouldn't eat it? What's that?
It's better not to.
So
how hungry are you? How hungry are you and how much porridge do you have?
There's nothing else that you'd eat the straight bacon. I was going to say, would it matter if you had less porridge? Like if you were poor and that was all the porridge you had? Those are the kinds of things you would have to take into account.
If you had no food and for sure, like let's say it's permissible, but the question is, let's say you're a rich man and you have other porridge, and you could just throw that porridge out and it doesn't matter. Should you throw it out or should you eat it?
You should eat it.
Why?
Because you're able to uplift the big.
Exactly. It's Eshet Yefator. That is Eshet Yefator. It's the exact same idea.
Okay, folks. Again, a lot of typical Judaic, Hebraic word salad there. But there's actually a lot in hearing and listening to that, in unpacking, to use the word that stinking rabbi used, when we unpack it, where we will understand better the perverse nature of how the Jewish brain works. He says something very, very telling, folks. He said, there is nothing that is totally forbidden by the Torah. Now, again, folks, hate to have to beat a dead horse here, but he says there's nothing that is totally forbidden in the Torah. He doesn't say the Talmud. He doesn't say the Kabbalah. He doesn't say Zohar or any of these other pieces of Judaic literature, which a whole host of quote-unquote experts within the 9/11 truth movement say that this is what dictates Jewish behavior. This is why there's this invasion going on, this destruction, wholesale slaughter taking place in Gaza, is because of the Torah, in contravention to the peaceful moral teachings found, is that all of this is happening because of the Talmud, in contravention and disobedience and contradiction to the peaceful and godly teachings found within the Torah. Well, here we have this stinking rabbi who says quite plainly that there is nothing that is totally forbidden in the Torah. Now, let's just go down the list of some possible things here, folks. Murdering innocent human beings. There's a time and place, according to this rabbi, where the Torah permits it. And we know this is the case, folks, because all you have to do is go back and read for yourself the first five books of Moses, and especially what happens to the unlucky Gentiles living in the Holy Land when the Hebrews show up and they begin invading their villages and slaughtering them wholesale, leaving nothing alive that breathes. Okay, so we'll start with that. Murder. What about having sex with children? Yes, absolutely. It is something that is not forbidden in the Torah, because as you're going to hear here in just a moment, folks, in this discussion that's taking place, they state very clearly, okay, that the little girls, the little virgin girls, the Gentile girls that they meet in battle, that they can keep them for themselves. Okay. Now, the men, you have to slaughter them. The boys, you have to slaughter them. The women who have been with another man, you have to slaughter them. But all the little girls who have not yet lost their virginity, you are to keep for yourselves. Now, folks, I'm pretty sure, that keeping them for themselves has a sexual connotation to it. Okay, I don't think you keep them for yourselves as, to come and wash your car, to vacuum your rugs or whatever. I'm pretty sure there's a sexual connotation to that. So here we have this stinking rabbi talking about how even the things that appear to be forbidden, like for Jews, they don't eat pork. Okay. And then he goes through this big disputation here about a circumstance where it's okay to eat the pork. Okay. So something that is forbidden, there is a case where it's not forbidden. Okay. And he gives the case, you know, and they throw in all these numbers. If there's 60 times more porridge than there is pork, then you're allowed. Okay, this is the basis for the Talmud, folks. This is what the Talmud is where these stinking rabbis throughout history have gotten together, and they have taken a topic such as eating pork, okay, which is generally forbidden by the Torah. No, unequivocally forbidden by the Torah. Doesn't say in certain cases you're allowed to do it. And where these stinking rabbis have over the centuries since the destruction of the temple and all the rest of that, they've gotten together and they have debated and discussed certain criteria where it would be permitted to eat pork. This is what the Talmud is. Everybody says, oh, they're two totally different books, the Talmud and the Torah, totally different. No, it's not. The Talmud is just a collection of rabbinical opinions, pro and con, on various items as they have appeared in the Torah. And those circumstances where a follower of Judaism is supposed to either do A, B, or C, or X, Y, and Z. Okay, that's all that it is. And you can hear for yourself how the Jewish brain works in this regard, okay? Where you get all of these Jews together in one room and they're throwing out these different ideas. And interestingly enough, on this issue of pork and porridge, you know, this stinking rabbi says, you know, let's say that, you know, this bacon falls into my porridge. Should I eat it? And there's one of the women folk replies, she says, you should, because by eating the bacon, you're uplifting it and making it holy. Why? Because it's going into the mouth and down the gullet of a Jew. And because a Jew is holy, he's the physical manifestation and representation of God on earth. Therefore, this thing that is otherwise impure and therefore forbidden is made sanctified and holy because it has now gone down the throat of this follower of Judaism. And he uses, now remember something, folks, all of this is taking place within the context of the discussion of whether or not it's permissible for Hebrew soldiers to rape Gentile women who are considered unclean and unpure like swine, like pigs. Okay, you're not supposed to marry them, interact with them, have intercourse with them. It's like having sex with a sow. But in those cases in battle, okay, where your sexual urge is just too strong and you can't control it anymore, you can go ahead and do it because what you have just done is you have elevated the status of that woman by raping her, by her having been raped by a Hebrew soldier. You have elevated her status. That's exactly what they are saying within the context of this discussion. Yes, folks, this is how the Jewish brain works. All right, let's continue.
You are Hashem made it so that forbidden piece of food would fall into your porridge, and now it's been rendered permissible.
And okay, so why shouldn't we put little pieces of bacon in all of our...
You're not allowed to do it.
You're not allowed to do it intentionally.
Why?
It only matters if it's unintentional. So wait, practical question now.
But the bacon doesn't suffer like the woman that you're
making. Yeah, exactly. A Kohen in battle.
This is really important.
Practically speaking. A Kohen in battle. A Kohen, is he permitted to take a woman in battle or not?
It's a dispute. The problem is that a Kohen, and this is one of the, maybe actually we can look at it this way, a Kohen, the question is, this law is a totally new law, like no one's ever heard of it before. It's like the Torah made this whole new law that you're allowed to now sleep with a Gentile woman under these circumstances. Okay? Which is weird. Now the question is it because it's a totally new law, does it apply to all Jews, including Kohanim? Or, since the Kohanim actually have a different religion than the people of Israel, like they have different mitzvot than I do, like the Kohen, he has different mitzvot than I do, is this law not applicable to the Kohen? That's the question that's asked in the Gemara. And the answer is, first of all, for those who say that it's a way of compromising with the Yetzer Hara, like that the person couldn't withhold, just like he was starving in battle and he had to eat the bacon or he had to drink Jesus wine or whatever it was. So if it's a compromise with the Yetzer Hara, then the Kohen should be able to do it as well, because he also has Yetzer Hara. But
so can he take her back and marry her after?
The problem is that you have an obligation once you've taken this woman as a prisoner, right? As you've taken this woman as a prisoner, you have to marry her. You have to marry her. And she has to become your wife.
And the Kohen cannot.
And the Kohen can't marry her. Because she's a convert. What's that?
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the dispute. And the Chachamim, the sages, debate about it. The halakha in the end is that he can take her once, but he cannot marry her. But I think when I read the Rambam, it looks to me like they have to go through the whole process of conversion.
There's two versions of the machloket.
Yeah.
Okay. There's one where Rav says he can perform the initial act and take her back and marry, and Shmuel says he can perform the initial act and not take her back. Right. And the other version of the same debate is that Rav says Rav says he can rape her in battle but not take her back, and Shmuel says he can't even rape her in battle.
Correct.
Right. And the Rambam in the end rules like that he can rape her in battle but not take her back.
Correct. That he takes her back, but he can't marry her.
Hmm.
What's that?
Make her part of Israel.
Look, the truth is it's not clear. She can't become his wife.
but she goes through the process of conversion.
But who would want to marry her after she's been raped?
Also, I think that that's one of the
ideas. No, in that, like in that.
No, but it's like one of the ideas that if you, I think the Torah actually very much limits the ability for us to do this. We can talk about it as an idea, and we can say, ah, yes, the Torah, great, I'm going to go out the battle. But the reality is that there are very, very strict stipulations. Number one, yeah, if you're going to do that, but you know you're going to be stuck with that woman forever, okay? Like, that's not a good, not forever, you can divorce her afterwards, but you have to marry her afterwards. And do you really want to do that? So that's going to turn off, like, half the guys.
Right, that's the way on the mind of the Yisrael and the Levi, but if there's nothing to weigh on the mind of a Kohen, what's to stop him from just going crazy at war?
No. You can only take one woman.
Only one.
Every battle.
One woman per battle.
One woman per battle. And,
as long as they have a limit.
Right. And it has to be. Well, that was one of the problems why they said, like, how did David Melech have 400 of these kids?
Right.
And someone wanted to say that they had, like, maybe he just had a lot of twins and triplets or something. Because he didn't have 400 battles.
Yeah.
We don't know that he had 400 battles. So how do you get it? So the answer is actually that these 400 soldiers of his were not only his children, it was like his soldiers' children as well.
They meant David.
What? I'm sorry?
Clarify, they meant David Melech.
David Melech, correct. Yeah. Also, there's a stipulation that you can only take one, obviously, I said. And it has to be like a situation where you like just cannot not succumb to the Yetzirah. Okay? And who's going to be judge of that? But like I said, like that's a common thing in battle, especially in all battle. That's what happens, and it also has to be in a state where the woman. It's the first time you saw her. Like you can't be like I saw this woman yesterday. Okay, now we're going to go to war, and when she's captured, I want that one. Then you're not allowed to take her. Only if it's the first time you saw her is when she's been captured in battle, and it has to be at that moment. And then you have to take her back. You can't obviously have intercourse with her in front, in public or in front of anything. You have to take her to your home. And the truth is that according to Rashi, you're not even allowed to have intercourse with her until she goes through the whole process. The process that we talked about
at first.
That's the Rashi that Rashi goes through. Okay, and that's how he sees it.
So you have to wait until the battle is done at the very least.
Yeah, yeah. You can't do it. It's not in the heat of battle. Like you choose her. In the heat of battle, when there's like
prisoners. Can you change your mind at any point?
What do you mean?
Like before the rape happens, can you change your mind at any point and be like, actually,
are we sure that there can't be a rape during the battle?
Yeah, no, that's not possible. It's forbidden. It's forbidden to be in the battle. In the time of the battle, it has to be take her to your home, into an intimate location, and then
it can't be like your army tent.
I don't know. We'd have to look. We haven't had these laws in so long. I mean, it'll be until we start to remember them.
I mean, there's obviously no mikveh required.
Okay. Yeah, folks, this is not a Monty Python skit. It's not a skit from Saturday Night Live. This is the real deal. God's chosen people talking about the mechanics of raping Gentile women that they take in battle. Now, where this particular section of the discussion began, it was discussing the rules regulating a Jewish priest in battle and whether or not he is allowed to rape, and then what is he supposed to do. Well, the problem is with a Jewish priest is that he cannot rape or he cannot marry a Gentile woman. Now, the way that the Jews, the Hebrews, the Israelites, Judeans, Judites, Khazars, whatever word we want to use in describing them, folks, it all means the same thing. The way that they have got this worked out in their brain. Remember, revisit what we heard in the previous section where our stinking rabbi says there's nothing that's totally forbidden within Judaism. Okay. This is the elasticity of Judaism. This is how they take something, a thou shalt not. And they come up with exceptions for it so that they can skirt the law, they can evade whatever it is that they're not supposed to do, and so that they can give in to their evil inclinations, okay? Like no other religion on earth, folks. You know, we all were subject to these unending lectures, and we still are to this day, these idiots among us who, you know, because they listen to, there's somebody that they listen to who's supposedly an expert on Islam, and Islam, you know, they say Islam permits this thing where they're allowed to lie to their, I think it's called taqiyya, T-I-T-A-Q-U-I-A-H, something like that, taqiyya, where they're permitted to lie to their enemies in order to overcome them. And you get these absolute idiots who start quoting, throwing all this stuff out. There's no such thing. I mean, in just as it is with true Christianity, okay, there are fixed and immovable boundaries on behaviors where you're not allowed to do them. And there's no excuse. There's no justifiable situation where it's okay to have sex with a child, to rape another woman, to eat a human being, to kill them and to eat them. Okay. In Judaism, however, there is nothing that is forbidden. Nothing that is totally forbidden. And the only reason why they maintain this outward appearance of having rules that say that they're not allowed to do this and they're not allowed to do that is to fool the rest of us, folks. That's what they are there for. This is the exactly what Jesus said, you know, that they look like whitewashed tombs. You know, they make sure that on the outside they look like, you know, this thing that's clean and pure and whole. Inside, they are full of rotting carcasses, dead men's bones. So let's see. He's talking about, you know, the regulations involving a Kohen, meaning a Jewish priest in battle. You see, he can't marry the woman because she's not Jewish. She's a Gentile, but he's allowed to rape her. Okay. He's allowed to violate her. He's allowed to rape her, but he's not allowed to marry her. And so that's what that discussion was all about, okay? And at one point, one person asked, you know, well, then why bring her back with you if you can't marry her? And they said, well, to make her part of Israel. And what that means, folks, is as a slave, okay? As a slave. So she's going to be a house cleaner. She's going to be a hairdresser. She's going to pluck the armpit hairs out of for Jewish women, you know, all the nasty things that they would have to do for them, just like the Palestinians are forced to do today. Shabbos goy, okay? That's why she's brought back. If she's been raped by the Kohen, by the priest, is that she becomes a slave for the Jews. Okay, folks, let's just pick it up.
No, she's not only that. I'll say something not so nice that will upset people. But it could be that she's a married woman. She could be a married woman. So,
well, not according to our laws.
Not according to our laws, but according to the idol worshippers.
You're taking her back. What's that? Probably because you killed her husband, so she's now family.
That's why
you're bringing her back.
Well, that's one of the reasons why you're bringing her back.
The widow's permissible.
What's that?
The widow's permissible.
Well, it could be you didn't kill her husband. Maybe he just ran away.
But and you're not obligated to take her kids with her, just kids?
No, but you can take slaves in battle.
Oh, I'm sure.
That's what people know.
No, take the female kids as slaves, not the male kids.
Okay, folks, that was a real short thing there because I got to jump in here before it gets lost. So then they're talking about, you know, this woman, okay, who is going to be raped. And he says, you know, the bad thing is that maybe she's married. And but the other guy, the other stinking rabbi chimes in and says, well, not according to our laws. Now, remember, folks, the whole thing, you know, we always hear all about the Ten Commandments and how they totally transformed the nature of human civilization, as if before the Ten Commandments, people didn't know that murder was wrong, that theft was wrong, lying was wrong, and coveting another man's wife. So what these Jews have, especially these stinking rabbis, what they have done is they have constructed a system of morals here where it says, okay, you're not supposed to covet another man's wife, but that guy over there, the Gentile, okay, the man, just like the Palestinian man, who's the head of his family and he's trying to protect his family, you know, as you Hebrew soldiers are invading his country, okay, they're not married because they're not Jews. Okay. They're just like animals, that mate and reproduce, but they're not married. And therefore, because they're not married, you, the Hebrew soldier, you can covet that man's wife because it's not really his wife. You can kill him and you can take her because it's, he's there. And by the way, folks, I want to just throw in something very quickly here. I meant to bring it up, earlier. A quote from Ariel Sharon, who was a general in these wars in 1948. He was quoted saying, "I encourage my soldiers to rape the Palestinian women because the Palestinian woman is a slave for the Jews. And there's nothing that there's nothing that anybody can tell us what to do in that regard." And people say, "Oh my gosh, you know, what a barbaric thing." No, 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 folks. He's a good Jew. He is a Torah true Jew for saying that and for encouraging his soldiers to rape Palestinian women. Okay. And then you hear here within this discussion taking place, folks, where, you know, he says, "Well, you can take them as slaves," because the one of the women asks, "Well, what if she has children?" And he says, "Well, you can take them as slaves," you know, and he does it very matter-of-factly. No shame in his voice, folks. The words just come falling out of his mouth, pardon the imagery here, folks, just like verbal diarrhea, which is exactly what it is, okay? This filth coming out of his mouth. "Oh, you can take them as slaves." And then the other rabbi chimes in and he says, "But not the boys." So here you have this Gentile woman just killed her husband, and she's got kids. "Well, you can keep them as slaves except the boys, because they're commanded to kill the boys, the little boys. But the little girls who have not yet lost their virginity, you can keep for yourselves." All right, let's pick it up again, folks.
It depends on what kind of battle it is. Again, I think we have to understand, like, the laws of battle also. The laws of battle, and I think it really would help us, like, if we were to internalize this today. The law of battle is very clear. You give people three choices. Like, if you have, you're laying siege to a city, you give people three choices. You can either run away, right? You can come and join us. No problem. Come and join us. You have to have that option open. Or you can come out and fight us. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I would claim that one of the problems in the morality of the wars that the current state of Israel has fought, like against the Palestinians and against the Arabs and so forth, is that we haven't actually actualized the option of coming and joining us. Like, that option has not been out there as a real option. And that's one of the things that we have to be able to learn and to think about.
When you say that the 1948 that was an option, like the Arabs could have stayed where they were, and Israel wouldn't have necessarily gone against them and killed them, so they did have that option to stay or to leave, and then that's what's been in contest since then, is the ones that left then want
right.
to be able to come back. So we did exercise that option at one point.
Well, I don't think, the question is coming and joining us, does coming and joining us mean to come and live in a liberal Western democracy that promises full equality, but in fact is called a Jewish democratic state, in which case you always, what you're being promised and what you're actually getting are two different things? Mm-hmm. Or does coming join us mean something else? So I would claim, I mean, that argument could be made, but I'm not sure that that's the meaning of come and join us.
Okay, folks, real quick, I want to jump in before I lose my train of thought here. So here they're talking about, you know, in the business of invading these villages, territories, whatever, that you give them three options. Number one, you can run away. Number two, you can join us. Or number three, you can fight. Now, this is no different than somebody who pulls a gun on you or a knife on you and says, "Give me your wallet." Now, you have two options. Either you give him the wallet or he's going to knife you and take it from you. That's the same logic. Now, where our stinking rabbi, you know, he tries to put lipstick on this pig, on the pig of Judaism, by saying, "Or you could come and join us." You know how he uses that. Their voices, folks, just absolutely. I mean, you can hear. Never mind. He says, "You can come and join us." Now, he does make very clear. Okay, because that sounds really nice. Oh, come and join you. Okay, as slaves, folks, not as equals. And he even says that later. He says, you know, this is one of the reasons why we find ourselves in the mess that we're in right now with the Arabs, because we never offered this to them. When we came in and started taking the land from them, we never gave them the option of joining us. And then one of the women folk, throws in the question, what do you mean by that? Come and join us. And he says, well, we would tell them one thing, but it would be something else entirely. It would be a different thing. And what that means, folks, is that you come and join the people of Israel as slaves. Okay. Meaning you do their work for them. You do all of the things that they don't want to have to do, whether it's building their houses, mowing their lawns, cleaning out the sewers and the septic tanks, you know, work for Gentiles. Okay. That's what that means. Okay, let's pick it up, folks.
Like, I don't think that's the meaning of, for example...
to coexist. It means actually join us as a people.
Like, what's that? That's right. Say again?
Come and join us doesn't mean merely just coexist amongst us. It means actually join our peoplehood, like become...
Well, not become Jewish, but to live among us in a way that what's called Gertoshav, the idea of Gertoshav. Is the idea of a non-Jew who comes and lives in Hebrew society, retains his own identity and his own unique way of life, but has joined in, accepts the seven Noahide laws, and is also loyal to the Jewish people in the land of Israel.
Like the Edomites.
Like the Druzim?
The Druzim are like that, I think.
Yeah, the Druzim are the Druzim are probably the classic example. At least what we have today of what a Ger Toshav would be.
Right.
Because they've made it very clear as a community that they accept their sovereignty, which is one of the necessary requirements to be a Ger Toshav. You have to accept Yisrael's sovereignty in Eretz Israel. And on some level, they're Noahites, because they still, on some level, believe in the God of Abraham.
Right.
So it seems like, as far as I'm concerned, maybe anybody could challenge me, I think they're the only obvious example of a Ger Toshav in our society. Unfortunately, maybe Yehuda and I will disagree with this. I don't see, for sure as of now, I don't see like the Islamic groups in like Hamas or like maybe no, it's because we have fell short in terms of what we have to offer. Like those three.
Has that option ever been on the table?
No, not clearly at least. Not explicitly. Not explicitly, but can you answer why the Druzim? Maybe you can. I mean, I know it has to do with their culture, because like they generally have this belief that they're loyal to any sovereign power that they live under. But do you think that there's anything else that's deeper as to why it's just the Druzim that are Gerim Toshavim now, and not yet the Muslim people?
I think actually one of the things that we have to talk about is the idea. First of all, I think we have to understand that Druze are a minority, a very persecuted minority. That's why they live in the high mountains. Why they live in the high mountains? Because that was hard for people to get to. And so every community they built was high up in the mountains in southern Syria or southern Lebanon and northern Israel. They were a persecuted minority, and all of a sudden, when we came around, like the Jewish people came here on the scene, and we were powerful. They had a natural ally to join with. The Arabs, I think, first of all, are a very powerful nation. They're a very large nation, and they have a lot of people behind them. Okay, and so they have a lot of honor, also kavod, like with self-respect. And the Jewish people coming here and taking part of what they consider to be part of their land. It's a problematic thing for them, and it's not so quick that they're going to succumb. For the Jews, it's easy. For the Arabs, it's a long, hard, difficult process, and that's the problem.
Okay, folks, I'm going to jump in here real quick before I lose my train of thought. They're talking about, why they specifically mentioned the Druze, which is a minority in Israel. Why the Druze have basically bent over for the Jews and have tried to assimilate, and the Arabs won't. And, you know, the stinking rabbi in typical Jew speak says, well, you know, the Arabs, they're a strong people, and they have a lot of honor and all the rest of it. No, folks, the reason why the Arabs, Christians and Muslims, don't want to be part of Jewish society is because the Arabs, both Christian and Muslim, have very, very strong moral codes. Okay. They strictly adhere to the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots. The Jews, however, do not do this because, as our stinking rabbi here has made very clear, the Jews have an exception where anything is permitted. Anything. Raping children, eating other human beings, enslaving people, mass murder. And this just goes to underscore, again, folks, how the Jewish brain works. They will come up with every possible explanation for something except the one that fits. Because if it in any way complicates or contradicts what they have envisioned for themselves, for their own empowerment and all of the rest of this stuff, then they will come up with 1,000 different explanations. I mean, you just look at the debates over quote-unquote anti-Semitism. It's because the Gentiles envy us. It's because of Esau and Jacob. It's because they know that we are the manifestation, representation of God on earth, and they're driven by these satanic and diablical forces. But everything except the fact that the Jews as a people, the Hebrews, Israelites, whatever word we want to use in describing them, that they follow a code of ethics that is predatory, that is criminal in nature, that basically is the brainchild of Satan himself. And everywhere they have gone, and all you have to do, folks, is, again, go back and read your Old Testament. First recorded act of quote-unquote anti-Semitism was when Pharaoh kicked Abraham and Sarah out of Egypt after he found out that Abraham lied to him by saying that Sarah was only his sister instead of his wife. And when Pharaoh's entire household came down with venereal disease after bringing Sarah into the home, he figured out, hey, maybe Sarah wasn't the virgin that Abraham described her as being. And he said to Abraham, why have you dealt with me so treacherously? Now, take your wife and leave my country. The very first recorded act of anti-Semitism, folks. And it wasn't based on envy. It wasn't based on Pharaoh being driven by Satan's rage against God. It was based upon simple cause and effect, that Pharaoh's whole household came down with VD because of bringing Sarah in, and he only did this because Abraham lied about her status as his quote-unquote sister. Okay, okay, folks, let's pick it up.
That's the process that we're in, the process of clarification. I think part of the process is also of the Middle East separating, and I think it is already starting to separate back into its kind of like tribal outfits. There is no really unified Arab nation, and in fact, a lot of the peoples who call themselves Arabs, actually, we all of a sudden are finding, you know, discovering that there's Kurds, and there's Armenians, and there's Arameans, and there's all these different, actually, tribal identities that were, in essence, also, like we talked about before, colonized by Arab expansion. Okay? And that also will be part of the process, I think, of us building, and what I believe we have to do here is to build a blend of these different nations, and I think that the Arabs also should be a part of it, but on the basis of what the things that we talked about here, like the seven mitzvot ben noach.
So how do we do it now? As just what we have in front of us, how do we present these three options now to the Arabs who live among us?
I'll tell you what I suggested, okay, in my yishuv. And I kind of did it as a joke, but I was actually serious. It was like an educational joke, like a serious educational joke. We have Arabs that come and build the houses. For some people use only Jewish labor, some people use Arab labor because it's cheaper and sometimes better, and depends. So there was an argument when the current hostilities broke out, whether we should continue to allow Palestinians to come in and build houses. And there were people who said no. Like, who knows, they might gather intelligence, who knows, they might come and attack us. Also, we want to hurt them, we want only Jewish labor here. So there was an argument. I knew already that which side would win out, that the side that would win out would be the side that would allow Palestinians to continue to build, because it was just a tremendous difference economically. Like, it was just much, much cheaper. And there weren't enough people. I already felt there weren't enough people that would be able to prevent the Palestinians from coming in. And people were in the process of building already as well. So what I suggested was, what we should do is we should go to the contractors, the Arab contractors, and say, look, we have this problem, like people, you know, don't trust you, don't want you to come in. What should happen is, we want only, we would like you to come up before like our Beit Din, anyone who you're bringing in, that we should know who that person is, that's going to be coming and working. And he should declare that I wouldn't call it the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, but he should declare that before Allah, that it's forbidden for him to murder, that it's forbidden to steal, that it's forbidden to have sexual immorality. All these things, and we would have a position already of a contact and an opening of a moral dialogue between us. We would know who he is.
Okay, folks, again, I had to jump in before I lost my train of thought. So anyway, he's talking about, you know, that when, now this is back 7 years ago or so, and he said, you know, back when today's hostilities began, we had this big debate whether or not we should allow Palestinians into Israel, and I knew which side was going to win because the Arabs provide better quality work for a cheaper price. And that the Jews were going to choose that they were going to want the Palestinians, even though supposedly they pose a security threat. They do better work than Jews as house builders and contractors and all the rest of that stuff. And they do it for less money. And he says, okay, so here's how he, as this stinking rabbi, proposes that they do this, that they bring in a contractor and they force him to swear by Allah, as he says, that they're going to renounce murder, stealing, and sexual immorality. Right, folks, the Muslims. Murder is expressly forbidden. In war, Islamic soldiers are not allowed to kill civilians. They're not allowed to harm women, children. They're not allowed to harm the old. They're not even allowed to cut down a tree, folks. Stealing, we know what happens in Islamic law. If you're caught stealing, you get your hand cut off, supposedly. And sexual immorality, okay? The Muslims are actually more conservative in terms of sexual morality than Catholics are, Christians. And yet these Jews, and especially this stinking rabbi, he says, okay, this is how we're going to fix the situation, where we're going to allow these Palestinian laborers, slaves in effect, to come in and do this work for us that we need to get done, that we're going to make them swear by Allah that they're renouncing murder, stealing, and sexual immorality. All of these things which the Jews engage in as part of the regular practice of their religion. Okay, there's just a little bit more here, folks, we're going to listen to, and then we're going to try and wrap it up.
Know who he is, he would know who we are, we respect him for that, he would respect us for that, and there would be a place of mutual respect on the basis of not only economics, but a moral basis.
Okay, folks, I apologize. I didn't know that it was almost at the end there. Okay, so anyway, you can see here, folks, how the Jewish brain works, okay? What he's doing, in effect, is he's saying, oy, we need these Gentiles to do this work for us, but, we've been murdering them for 75 years, raping their women in battle and all of the rest of that. So, you know, how do we whitewash this arrangement, okay, so that we can allow them into our community to do this slave labor that we need to get done? Well, we're going to frame it all within the context of these high-minded moral ideas, okay? We're going to agree that the Palestinian is not going to murder. The Palestinian is not going to steal. The Palestinian is not going to engage in sexual immorality. And remember, folks, this stinking rabbi is saying all of this within the context of Judaism's commandments to go out and to murder, to steal, and to engage in sexual immorality, meaning raping Gentile women. He has the nerve, the gall, the chutzpah to engage in some type of an agreement with this Palestinian who's only alive right now because somehow he escaped whatever it was that the Jews were planning to do to him and to his family. That in order to get this Gentile into Israeli society so that he can continue on acting in that function as a slave for the Jews, that he's going to renounce all of these immoral things which the Jews themselves consider to be moral for them when they do it. This is how the Jewish brain works, ladies and gentlemen. It is a completely demented, deranged, dysfunctional, and not today, folks, not the quote-unquote Khazars, you know, that we hear so much about, not because of the quote-unquote Talmud, folks, going all the way back to the very beginning of the affair. You know, I was having a an email exchange with a good friend of mine the other day, and he sent me a video of some fellow in Northern Europe, put together a very good video on, you know, what's going on in Gaza and all the rest of that. And this fellow, who obviously is a Christian, very well-intentioned, I can tell he's got a good soul, but he says, you know, the Jews need to return to the peaceful, moral teachings and traditions of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, King David, Solomon, Moses, and all the rest of that. And I responded to my friend. I said, well, he was doing okay there with everything until he went there. Because all of those people that he listed in his video, none of them were moral people. They were murderers. They were liars. They were rapists. Jesus himself said this when he talked about himself as the good shepherd. And he said, all of the shepherds who came before me were thieves and liars. Who were those shepherds, ladies and gentlemen? Who were they? At least according to the Judaic text found within the Old Testament, they were people like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Solomon, David, Moses, and all the rest. Jesus didn't praise them as holy men. He said they were all thieves and liars. Okay. Now, folks, I realize this has been a long coming up on 2 hours. My goodness. I appreciate your patience. We still have another section of this to cover, and it actually gets a lot worse, folks. But we have to remember something, okay? I mean, it's like, you know, I saw a picture the other day. Somebody had taken a house down in Florida somewhere where this alligator, somebody driving in the neighborhood, took a picture of his neighbor's house. There was an alligator standing on its hind legs who was pushing the doorbell of the front door at the house of his neighbor. He took a picture of it. Now, what kind of a person would, when they hear the doorbell, would open it, see this alligator there, and say, come on in, and say, yeah, let's make a pet out of this thing? You wouldn't, because you know the nature of the alligator, okay? Alligators don't make good pets. Likewise, and the reason why, folks, is because of the way that their brains function, their natures. Their brains function as extreme predators. And, you know, the wise person understands, I'm not, you know, I love animals, but I'm not bringing this thing into my house as a pet. Likewise, when it comes to the Jewish brain, folks, as it has been destroyed by thousands of years of the Judaism, which has been used as this toxic and intoxicating spiritual substance, okay? It is a Judaism is like a dog that was born with rabies, born with it. And now it's in the latter stages of that infection. Okay. There's no difference, just time. The Hebrews, Jews, Judeans, Israelites of today, the only difference between them and their ancestors of 4,000 years ago is time, like the difference between the baby alligator and the adult. And we have to understand this. Now, folks, I'm not going to fill you with a bunch of unwarranted hope and optimism. I think that we find ourselves in a situation very, very similar to when Israel deliberately attacked the USS Liberty in 1967. Okay. Mass death, murder, carnage, bombs going off, ships taking on water, ship is defenseless, has no hope. I mean, it was a done deal as soon as that day was born, folks, that that ship was going to go down. And it was only by a miracle, by the grace of God, that it didn't. And of course, the efforts of the men on board the Liberty who did everything they could to keep it from sinking. Because if it had sunk, folks, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now. If that ship had sunk, World War III would have begun. Likewise, you know, our situation today is very bleak. There's not a lot to hope for, except for a miracle. That's what we have to hope for. And until that time, folks, as all of our lives continue on this process of falling apart, which they are, and I'm telling you, warning you, folks, a lot worse is to come, and not just in places like Gaza. All over the world, and especially in the United States, we are going to see things, experience things, taste things that we never imagined that we would. And it's coming a lot sooner than any of us would like to imagine. And knowing why, okay, it's not going to make it go away. And any hope we have of turning things around, I think, is unwarranted hope. It's just like on the attack of the Liberty, okay? There was no hope in bringing all of these sailors back to life who had been killed. There was no hope in, you know, the only thing they could do was to keep the ship afloat. And that's all that we can do, and which we are trying to do with conversations of this type. So that, and all folks, as I hope, that these things that I say in the very imperfect and flawed way that I'm trying to bring this message about, that you, it will give you better ammunition in going out and trying to, you know, wake up these masses of asses right now. The fact that they are walking, sleepwalking right into World War III. Do I have a lot of hope that this is going to happen? No, folks. I mean, I hope so, okay? But I think that the best thing to do is to brace for the blows that are headed our way. So that in the event that, we'll just have to wait and see, folks. But in the meantime, you know, we really do need to just hope for that miracle. All right, so folks, that's it for today. I appreciate your patience. Yes, we are just almost about to round the 2-hour mark. I appreciate you giving me 2 hours of your time. I hope it was worth it. Those of you who are inclined to do so, who would like to help out with the costs associated with putting together programs of this type, there's a link there on the program at the bottom of it where you can click on that. And if you can't, folks, then please just spread the message, okay? I understand times are tough. People don't have a lot of money. The least you can do, the very least you can do, is to pass this link along, okay? It's just a click of a mouse. I say that because, you know, I have heard from people, yeah, I don't pass this stuff around because it's just too meaty, it's too complicated, and nobody's going to pay attention to it. Well, maybe they won't, but maybe they will. So please, pass these things around. Let's begin changing the discussion, folks, because if the discussion doesn't change, the discussion that's taking place right now doesn't change, then who knows how much longer there will be a system out there functioning where we can get together and have conversations of this type. So anyway, and folks, again, I meant to mention this at the beginning of the program. That insane Hebrew at the beginning of the program talking about Judaism, you know, being dangerous to everyone. Take those words to heart. If you don't pass around anything except that soundbite of him saying that, this is why we are dangerous to everyone. If you don't pass anything around but that soundbite, fine, just pass that one. Okay, folks, so today, let's see, as of right now, let's see, it is, okay, on this Sunday edition of the Ugly Truth broadcast, thank you for attending. Hope to see you all again next week, God willing. Until then, as I said, folks, let's do our best and let's pray for a miracle.